PRI, Public Radio International. It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
The global illicit drug economy is $400 billion. There's 180 million users, and this is equivalent to 8% of world trade, which is bigger than textiles, steel, or automobiles.
That's a lot of illegal drugs. But drugs is one of those issues, you know, like abortion, that you just don't talk about. Too loaded. But today, we're going to talk about it. Everything from the war on drugs to Kurt Cobain's heroin addiction. And a children's book you'll never forget.
This is the drug known as cocaine, made from the plants that people can't eat, raised by the farmers who work in the heat and fear the soldiers who guard the man who lives in the house that crack built.
In 1937, the U.S. criminalized marijuana. Hasn't stopped folks from getting high. Quite the contrary, really. 20 million Americans admit to smoking pot last year. And the government's response? Well, if the numbers mean anything, the answer's simple. Lock 'em up. Almost 700,000 Americans were arrested last year on marijuana possession charges. 5 million in the past 10 years. Eric Schlosser has a problem with those numbers. He critiques the war on drugs in a book called Reefer Madness. Steve Paulson asked Schlosser why he wrote a book about marijuana.
The editor of the Atlantic Monthly at the time, Bill Whitworth, called me up one morning and said, "Eric, is there anyone in prison right now for marijuana?" And it wasn't a subject that I thought much about or cared much about. And I said, "You know, I've got no idea." And he said, "Well, why don't you find out?" So I started looking around, and this was in the mid-90s, and I found out that not only were there some people in prison for marijuana, but there were more people in prison in the United States for marijuana than at any other time in our history, and some of them were serving life sentences without parole for relatively trivial marijuana crimes. That's what got me interested in the subject. It wasn't out of a desire to wave the cannabis leaf high and write a tract on behalf of the sacred herb. It was really about, how does a society come to do this to people?
You know, that was the thing that shocked me as I was reading your book. I had no idea that there are thousands of people in prisons serving marijuana charges.
Yeah. I mean, there are probably 20,000 in federal prison, maybe 25 to 30,000 in state prisons and in jails.
Are these people who've been dealing marijuana or just people who are using it?
No, these are just for simple possession of small amounts of marijuana.
Now, doesn't the punishment vary widely depending on what state you're in?
It varies enormously depending on where you are. It's this Byzantine maze of cannabis laws that we have in this country. I mean, we have drug laws that can be local, state, and federal, different laws. So 11 states have decriminalized marijuana, which means that if you're busted with a small amount, it's not even a criminal act. It's a civil fine like a parking ticket or a speeding ticket. And other states have very, very tough marijuana laws where you can get life without parole for a nonviolent marijuana crime or certainly do years in prison. In my research, I came to see that Oklahoma is probably the worst place to have marijuana in the United States. I write in the book about James Montgomery, a paraplegic who was smoking marijuana to relieve the phantom pains in his legs. And he was busted with 2 ounces of pot in the pouch on the back of his wheelchair. He had no criminal record, never been arrested for any reason ever before. And he was sentenced to life plus 16 years, which is...
Just for the possession of those 2 ounces.
He got life for the pot. And then he got the extra 16 years, which is just some cruel, perverse joke for the drug paraphernalia. And I think that he had a handgun in his house. He lived with his widowed mother, and his father had been a police officer, and it was his father's old handgun. So he got more time for that. And the government tried to seize the house because under the drug laws, you know, if marijuana is found in a house, then the house is technically involved in the crime too, and it can be seized by the government. The government tried to seize the house from his widowed mother, but was unsuccessful. And so James Montgomery was sentenced to life plus 16 and sent to prison, but eventually the prison authorities just didn't want him. He was a paraplegic. He became ill in prison. It was costing them a fortune to house him. The entire thing was absurd, and he is a free man today, but it was hard for me to discover how many. There are dozens if not scores, of people serving life without parole for pot in America.
And to put this in perspective, you're talking about sentences that are often stiffer than for people who've been convicted of murder.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you kill someone in the United States and you're convicted for killing somebody, you can expect to spend 11 years behind bars. If you rape somebody, it'll be significantly less than that. But I found many, many, many cases of people for marijuana, nonviolent offenders, getting sentences of 10, 20, 30, 40, life behind bars. It's extraordinary. And, you know, no other Western industrialized nation has sentences like this. You know, that section of my book is about marijuana, but it's also about this country and some of the fundamental changes that have happened in the last 20 years. And, I mean, how is it that you can punish someone more severely for marijuana than for killing someone with a gun? It has a lot to do with who smokes marijuana and, you know, a system that's designed to crack down on them pretty severely.
To me, one of the most striking things about this whole subject is the hidden economics of pot in the U.S. heartland.
That was one of the really eye-opening things about the story for me, and it was the beginning of my exploration of the underground economy, because here you have Indiana, rural Indiana, which on the surface looks like it's out of a Hallmark card with all these beautiful little farms that, you know, have the white picket fences around the lawn growing corn, and you would never expect that huge, huge fortunes are being made through drug dealing, and that there is this immense rural underworld, this rural underground economy in Indiana. The DEA agent who I spent time there argued that he really thought that marijuana was now the number one cash crop in Indiana, which is extraordinary because they grow a lot of corn there.
How do they grow the marijuana?
They grow it hydroponically inside, or more often they grow it hidden in the cornfields. The same soil and the same climate that's so wonderful for growing corn is also very good for growing marijuana.
Now, is this just a few growers here and there who are growing lots of marijuana, making a ton of money because it's illegal and you can get a lot of money for it? Or are we talking a lot of growers?
A lot of growers. And nobody has exactly what the numbers are, but it's not a centralized operation like the Cali cartel in cocaine or anything like that. There are vast amounts of marijuana being grown, not only in Indiana, but in Illinois and Missouri and in Kentucky and in California and on and on. And it tends to be a very dispersed market with lots of growers.
And most of the states that you just mentioned are kind of good, solid Midwestern states that, frankly, have a reputation for being rather conservative.
Well, they may be politically, but a lot of this started in the farm crisis in the 1980s. And as one farmer told me, you know, or told a researcher, you know, we've spent most of our lives fighting weeds. It's really not that hard to grow one. Marijuana is a plant that will grow wild in all 50 states. It's remarkably adaptable to different climates. And, you know, when you think about the low price of a bushel of corn, I think it's something like $3 or $4. And a bushel of marijuana, the statistics in the book, I think it's like $60,000, $70,000. So there's a real economic incentive to grow marijuana. And a lot of people who you wouldn't normally associate with the drug are growing it. We have this image of pot growers of being old hippie stoners from the 60s, and I don't think that's an accurate characterization anymore of who's growing pot and who's profiting from it.
Now, we've been talking about the draconian laws that have been instituted around the country against marijuana users and sellers, but it was not always this way in this country. You write about how the people who first settled in Virginia back in the 17th century were actually required legally to grow hemp.
It's incredible. I mean, the first marijuana law in America required every household to grow it. In the Virginia colony, hemp was considered a valuable commodity and a strategic commodity because of the rope used to make the riggings of sailing ships and canvas. And it had many, many uses, so it was considered important. And hemp in colonial days was so valuable and such a valuable commodity that in a number of colonies it could be traded as legal tender, used as legal tender instead of paper currency. It really wasn't until the early years of the 20th century that there were tough marijuana laws.
And well, I'm guessing that those Virginia farmers were not smoking it.
They were not smoking it. Although throughout the 19th century there was an awareness of the medicinal uses of cannabis, and a great many patent medicines had as their active ingredient marijuana. So, you know, there was hashish smoking among intellectuals in the late 19th century, but it was really in the early 20th century when poor Mexicans came to the United States, to the American Southwest, and brought their traditional means of intoxication, smoking pot, with them, that there was this outcry against the evil weed, against the killer weed. And marijuana became associated not just with poor Mexicans, but with poor blacks, and with all kinds of subcultures and minorities, and with the jazz musicians, and later with beatniks and hippies. And so the drug, you know, acquired this reputation of being linked to people who the mainstream hated or was afraid of. And that goes a long way in explaining, you know, why our marijuana laws are what they are today.
So you're saying there's a certain symbolic value that marijuana has. I mean, there's this whole association with the counterculture, with the people who don't want to fit in.
It has a huge symbolic importance for the people who condemn it and also for many of the people who smoke it. You know, aspirin doesn't quite have this powerful culture around it. Pot does. And one of the reasons that I'm such a strong supporter of decriminalization is to move away from, you know, this mythology surrounding pot. It's a plant. It's a drug. And yet we sing songs about, you know, songs are written about it and movies are made about it, and there's a huge culture around it, and it's invested with so much meaning by the people who oppose it as well. It's a symbol of counterculture, a symbol of defiance and rebellion. You know, our drug laws are based far more on cultural taboos than they are on any kind of rational appraisal of the substances involved and their real effects.
What would happen if marijuana was decriminalized throughout the United States? What would the ripple effect
be? If you were to decriminalize marijuana and allow adults to grow small amounts for personal use, the value of marijuana in the black market would immediately decrease. One of the reasons that an ounce of marijuana is often now worth more than an ounce of gold is because of the huge penalties for growing marijuana. So it's the black market that makes this weed so valuable. So the black market would shrink. And law enforcement resources that currently are being used to arrest almost 750,000 Americans a year for pot could be used for going after, I think, much more serious crimes and much more serious criminals. And I think the debate over drug use would have the volume turned down and might have more common sense and reason attached to it. And I think there are dangerous drugs that we need to strictly prohibit, but marijuana isn't one of them. And I think, you know, in the Netherlands, they have separated marijuana from the harder drugs legally. And as a result, kids in the Netherlands use hard drugs at a much lower rate than kids in the United States.
Eric Schlosser is a journalist and the author of a book called Reefer Madness. Steve Paulson spoke with him. So what do you think about legalizing cannabis? Why don't you send us an email through our website at www.ttbook.org. Coming up, how to talk to your kids about drugs.
How do I talk to my kid about this, that, or the other? They already know. They're already there. The how do you talk to them is not the subject matter itself, but the way in which you communicate with your child.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
This is the house that crack built. This is the man who lives in the house that crack built. These are the soldiers who guard the man who lives in the house that crack built. These are the farmers who work in the heat and fear the soldiers who guard the man who lives in the house that crack built. This is the drug known as cocaine, made from the plants that people can't eat, raised by the farmers who work in the heat and fear the soldiers who guard the man who lives in the house that crack built.
That's Cluck Taylor reading from his children's picture book called This Is the House That Crack Built. Though it uses the Mother Goose rhyme scheme of This Is the House That Jack Built, that's where the comparison ends. This is a gritty book about pain and terror, about the reality of crack cocaine. As you can imagine, a children's book on drugs is going to stir up some controversy. While many applaud Taylor for writing This is the House That Crack Built, others are less than thrilled. Steve Paulson asked Taylor the obvious question, is a book on crack really appropriate for children?
My wife was teaching kindergarten at a little private school in Louisiana. We left New York to my hometown, Louisiana. She was teaching there, and I went down to read the book to this little group of first graders at this little private school with the little uniforms and everybody sitting on the edge of their chairs. And I started to read the book to this little group of six-year-olds. And I'm reading, oh, this is the house that crack built. And I'm kind of explaining it in a little bit and, you know, keeping it really simple. And I get to about page three and this little blonde-haired girl raises her hand. And I said, and yes, what's your question? She said, we catch your drift. That's exactly what she said. And the other ones just nodded like, yeah, old guy, move on. We get it. You know, it's a, you know, it was a real eye-opener for me because I realized that the kids, they know this stuff. And if you're moving slowly through it, they're just way ahead. They're already there.
Do they really know all this? I mean, you're making references in this book to some big palatial mansion, probably in a, I don't know, you know, some Latin American country that's been, you know, built from the money from crack sales. I mean, this is all kind of sophisticated stuff.
Well, I think they certainly can get it pretty quick. Yeah, I mean, it's just in the news. I think kids know about it. And certainly the kids who we're trying to reach most importantly about this know about it.
Now, one of the things that happened with the success of this book is that mm-hmm. you were kind of turned into an anti-drug spokesman. I mean, the sort of the obvious reading of this book is it's the dangers of crack and how it can ruin a lot of lives.
Yeah, I suppose, but I never felt that way about the book. I felt it was just a way of explaining the truth of the traffic of drugs. So, you know, I never felt like a spokesman for an anti-drug.
Sounds like you didn't really want to become a spokesman. You didn't want to be part of the Just Say No campaign.
No, absolutely not. One of the powerful parts of the book is the this is quality to it. It doesn't say you shouldn't do anything. It doesn't make any judgments about your actions in the world. It just says this is this, and it implies and it shows that everything's connected. And so if you participate in any of this, then you're connected to all of it. And I think if we can let kids know without preaching to them that this is the way the world is, I think they appreciate that. This is the street of a town in pain that cries for the drug known as cocaine, made from the plants that people can't eat, raised by the farmers who work in the heat and fear the soldiers who guard the man who lives in the house that crack built. This is the gang, fleet and elite, that rules the street of a town in pain, that cries for the drug known as cocaine, made from the plants that people can't eat, raised by the farmers who work in the heat and fear the soldiers who guard the man who lives in the house that crack built.
We've already talked about the success of this book. I mean, it really became a phenomenon. It was grabbed onto by a lot of people. But there were some critics as well, weren't there? I mean, some people who are saying that there's an overly simplistic message here and maybe you're perpetuating certain stereotypes about mm-hmm. the black ghetto. Were you ready for that kind of criticism?
We definitely were. And the politically correct responses we got about ethnicity and cultural ethnic details in the book were mostly brought around by, frankly, Caucasian liberal folks who, you know, were trying to place that on it in a sort of a knee-jerk way.
You're saying they didn't like the depiction of essentially the scourge hitting black folks in the inner cities?
Let's look at it this way. We could have put a carload of suburban teenagers pulling up to buy crack to take back to, you know, Paradise Valley. But I think the saddest and the most truest and the realest, the harshest reality of it, we want to keep it down to the basic, you know, street level. And I think the urban poor, regardless of race, are the ones who suffer the most in this world. And by and large, we found that any time we were in urban and specifically ethnic neighborhoods where a lot of this is a big problem, bigger problem because of the gangs and because of the money and the trade itself, they welcomed this book. And I think they found it to be a great way to talk about this subject and to bring it up, especially in households where you may be missing a parent or things may be a little bit more difficult to communicate with each other. And this is a way for people to communicate. And I think the book brought some of communication into some homes that otherwise it might not have, with a message that was strong enough and honest enough for kids to pick up on and appreciate.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, you're really saying this opened up discussions between parents and their children. I mean, it's a tough discussion to have. I mean, how do you talk to your children about drugs when you kind of think that the just say no stuff is just too simple? I mean, you've got to deal with realities out there. How do you talk to children about drugs?
Well, I think in the simplest and most honest way possible, and that's where people, I think, get lost, is that they're trying to soft soap it. They're trying to, you know, how do I talk to my kid about this, that, or the other? They already know. They're already there. The how do you talk to them is not the subject matter itself, but the way in which you communicate with your child.
Of course, part of that honesty might be that, you know, you went through a period of taking drugs and you don't think there was anything wrong with that. That, you know,
right.
Maybe that was a rite of passage. Maybe that was kind of interesting. Maybe that was a way to connect to friends back in those times. And then, you know, do you want to tell your kids all of that?
Well, I think certainly a vast majority, or certainly a lot of adults with kids, experience drugs either personally or as a part of their world. And if we don't understand that and talk to each other about that, and especially to our kids, then that's dishonest. So I think the sooner you find a way to be honest about your own life, about the choices you made, and about experiences you've had and trying to impart them onto your kid, that's the best you can do.
Have you ever thought about doing a sequel? I don't know, a version for the new millennium, sort of drug poem for children?
Yeah, I do. I've always thought of it, but it always, as a comedian, generally, you know, you have this automatic cynic critic in your head that goes, come on, the house that Smack built, you know, it seems like a joke in your head, you know, when you think of it. You could actually write it. But the truth is that it's almost unnecessary to write it because, you know, you can just replace the word crack with heroin, methamphetamine, oil, and make the same connections up and down any vertically integrated line of human endeavor. And so I feel like the book tells a story that's a lot of stories, and you can extrapolate out from it. You can look outward from it. Then it relates to a lot of things in people's lives. And these are the tears we cry in our sleep that fall for the baby with nothing to eat, born of the girl who's killing her brain, smoking the crack that numbs the pain, bought from the boy feeling the heat, chased by the cop working his beat, who battles the gang, fleet and elite, that rules the street of a town in pain, that cries for the drug known as cocaine, made from the plants that people can't eat, raised by the farmers who work in the heat, and fear the soldiers who guard the man who lives in the house that crack built.
Clark Taylor reading from his children's book called This is the House That Crack Built. Steve Paulson spoke with him. Hunter S. Thompson wrote that you can turn your back on a man, but never ever turn your back on a drug. Everyone knows that drugs can change your life. Drugs can also change a city, even a whole generation. Scott Jennings knows this firsthand.
1991, and Seattle was crackling with energy, centering on a hot software company calling itself Microsoft, and a thriving local music scene. I remember turning on the radio in my friend's borrowed car, just in time to hear an interview with one of the local favorites, a band called Nirvana. They played their new song, and a love affair began. It flat out rocked with a passion I'd never heard before. The album Nevermind followed a month later. Start to finish, I thought the album was perfect. Soft and loud, self-loathing and rage, playful and sarcastic. They knocked Michael Jackson off the charts and sent big hair heavy metal bands to the bargain bin. They were a big middle finger to the music industry. I remember Nirvana coming back from its European tour and putting on a triumphant show at the Paramount Theater. The show seemed to me like a party to celebrate a culture that we had created, and Nirvana's frontman Kurt Cobain was our Pied Piper. The media labeled 92 the year of grunge, but for us in Seattle it was nothing but a nonstop party. Friends of mine from around the country came to crash on my couch and be a part of what was going on. Our lives centered around catching shows at the local clubs and listening to records and making sure we sobered up enough to get to work the next day so we could keep our jobs and have money to catch more shows and buy more records. And it wasn't just Nirvana. All of our favorite bands got signed to major deals. Pearl Jam, Mudhoney, Soundgarden were kings of the music world. I remember talking to my dad back home in Iowa and telling him that I felt like I was standing on my Haight Ashbury and that this was our summer of love. But a funny thing happened along the way. The music that we enjoyed, the clothes that we scraped together, was selling, and selling big. Money was to be made, and the record companies and fashion industry had taken notice. Suddenly, people in flannel were walking down fashion runways. Our grunge movement had been co-opted. The mosh pits we once enjoyed now felt like a set for an MTV video, and I hated it. Newcomers were accused of being posers, and the mood turned adversarial in the clubs, and the scene started to show a dark, ugly side. And of course, much like the original Summer of Love, there was a companion drug culture. Instead of LSD, it was heroin. Instead of drop out, turn on, and tune in, people dropped out, turned off, and tuned out. Nirvana's album In Utero came out in September of 93, and it caught the mood perfectly. It was dark. The first time I heard it, it gave me chills and not the thrilling chills I felt when I heard Nevermind. The opening lines of the opening song set the tone. Teenage angst has paid off well. Now I'm bored and old. And it continued. Most telling was the song Rape Me. I hated the self-indulgence, the pity, and the sense that Kurt was giving up, his newly acquired heroin addiction laid bare.
Rape me. Rape me, my friend. Rape me. Rape me.
Just like the Scenesters in Seattle had turned on themselves, Kurt was turning on himself, directing his once healthy cynicism of modern culture inward. From then on, it seemed like we were all on a countdown clock waiting for Kurt to check out. I'll never forget Kurt's performance on MTV's Unplugged, and it broke my heart.
Months later, on April 8, 1994, Kurt took his own life. Once again, I was sitting in my car when I heard it over the radio. The moment from the first time I heard Nirvana to then was just a mere 2.5 years apart. The cliche ending to what became a cliche life of a rock star. They had their Joplin, Morrison, and Hendrix. Now we had our very own.
Scott Jennings now lives in Madison, Wisconsin, with his record collection and his wife, Beth, who's expecting their second son.
Most of those who believe they should stop find it very difficult to do so. They find it's become a deeply ingrained habit, a habit they can't change just because they want to. I know about these things because I've been through it.
Later this hour, one addict's thoughts on the euphoria of the heroin high.
And I'd say it was like getting really, really good news, but better than that. You know, it's not a feeling you have to do heroin to feel, but what's seductive about heroin is that it makes the feeling infinitely repeatable. You can have it whenever you have $10.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. We often ask for your email through our website at ttbook.org, and many of you have responded. Sharon Fox of St. Louis, Missouri, was one of many to ask about Matty Stepanek. He was the young man featured in David Freudberg's storytelling in our show, Constructing the Narrative. She says, I love your program and use it as the basis for an information literacy assignment in my general education course called the Cornerstone Class. On the Matty Stepanek link, thanks so much. It was a powerful interview. You can send us email at ttbook.org. The title of Alfred McCoy's book says it all, The Politics of Heroin, CIA Complicity in the Global Drug Trade. First written in 1972 and recently revised, this meticulously researched book has become the source on the CIA's involvement in the global drug trade. McCoy says the CIA's complicity in the global drug trade isn't part of some evil design, it's just a matter of priorities.
The CIA during the Cold War found itself trying to contain communism. In Europe, that meant the Berlin Wall and NATO and the Warsaw Pact confrontation. But along the soft underbelly of Asia, across 5,000 miles from Turkey to Thailand, the southern frontier of the Soviet Union, the southern frontier of the People's Republic of China, there was a mountain rim of Asia that went from the Hindu Kush through the Himalayas through the Golden Triangle of Southeast Asia. And along these 5,000 miles of mountains, the CIA found itself mounting periodic covert operations, particularly along the kind of two choke points where the Highland Massif descends to the plains in the Golden Triangle of Southeast Asia and the Golden Crescent of Southwest Asia. And in this rugged, remote terrain, the CIA found that the only possible allies, the tribal warlords who could mobilize mercenary armies to fight communists in these remote mountains, also controlled the major commodity in both Afghanistan and in Highland Burma, opium. And so through their alliance with the CIA, these ethnic warlords became very quickly Highland drug lords. And they used the CIA's logistics, political protection, arms and supplies to build armies that expanded the production and processing and export of opium and heroin from these regions.
You're very matter-of-fact about this. It sounds as though it was a completely practical decision, but I think most Americans find it astonishing that an agency of our government could do that without considering the ethical consequences of it. Or did they simply decide that the practical matter was more important than the ethical matter?
I think at the start of this, the first of these covert operations, which started in 1950 in Highland Burma, only 2 years after the CIA was established, was a kind of bureaucratic accident. They sent out agents whose job it was to transform a ragtag remnants of the Nationalist Chinese Army into an effective force that could invade and liberate southwestern China from communist rule. That's a monumental task, and faced with this task of mobilizing militia forces half a world away from home all alone with just a few airplanes flying and guns and cash, that's a tall order, and I don't think Langley really asked too many questions about how this happened as long as it happened. Later on, by the time we got to the 1980s and early 1990s, when this had already happened in Burma and then in Laos, and in Laos with devastating consequences, as a result of the CIA tacit complicity with the Laotian drug lords, Laos opened the world's largest heroin laboratory, and the commander-in-chief of the Royal Laotian Army owned that lab. They shipped that powdering number 4 heroin to South Vietnam, where by 1971, 34%, one-third of all U.S. combat forces fighting in South Vietnam were, according to a White House survey, heroin addicts. So this was fairly widely known by the 70s. So in the 80s, when the two large covert operations that got involved in drugs got going, one in Central America to stop the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, and the other, same year, 1979, in Southwest Asia, the Golden Crescent, to stop the Soviet-sponsored government in Afghanistan. When these operations got going, they both got very quickly, very heavily entangled in drugs. And from field operative all the way to director of Central Intelligence, they were aware that both operations were intermingled with the drug traffic, and they were quite willing to tolerate it.
This was, again, though, a practical matter. It was always a balance. We know this is not what the American people really want, but they don't understand the needs of this. The practical matter is we need to cooperate with the drug lords if we are going to achieve these more important political aims.
Exactly. The United States spent, from 1979 to 1992, somewhere in the neighborhood of $2 to $3 billion to sponsor, to fund a massive Islamic revolution by the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. And as the Mujahideen took over territory in Afghanistan, they imposed an opium tax upon the peasantry. That's how they funded their operation, which cost far more than the $2 to $3 billion we were expending on the operation. Our leading ally at that time, who's now, by the way, the target of CIA predator drones trying to kill him, was a man named Gulbuddin Hekmatyar. He ran a whole complex of heroin laboratories. He received about half of the $2 to $3 billion. He was our chosen warlord, and he was a very active drug lord. Moreover, Pakistan Inter-Service Intelligence, which was the CIA's counterpart agency in the region, was very heavily involved in the traffic, and there were vast narco profits that were made. And this was understood at the time that this was going on, and this was necessary to the operation. In the 1990s, the former head of the CIA Afghan operation, a man named Charles Cogan, gave an on-camera interview, and he said basically there was fallout in terms of drugs. Yes, we knew that, but let's not lose our eye on the main objective here. The Soviets left Afghanistan. And the way he put those words together, I think, says it all. I mean, he knew it at the time. He knew there were consequences, and they were acceptable.
One of the things that astonishes me about all of this is that during this entire time, we have had periodic wars on drugs. The Nixon administration had a very, we thought, effective war on drugs. The Clinton administration talked a good game about a war on drugs. And you're saying in both cases, while that was going on, the CIA was giving lip service to the war on drugs, but also privately funding it?
In the era of the Cold War, we had two wars going, two wars against invisible enemies, one against communism and the other against drugs. And the war against communism started in 1948, and the drug war started in 1970. We're now in sort of phase five of the drug war. And in every instance, the Cold War trumped the drug war. And whenever there was a choice between keeping a DEA agent on station, a Drug Enforcement Administration agent on station who would be reporting negatively about the trafficking by CIA assets or allies, in every case, the CIA operation was given priority, the DEA operation was tamped down. Every time the CIA went into an area like Afghanistan or Honduras in Central America, where they ran a covert operation, the net result of a CIA operation was to create an enforcement-free zone, where local authorities wouldn't operate against the traffickers who were allied with us, and U.S. authorities, particularly DEA, would stay out of the area.
So we had a war on drugs, except where we didn't want anyone to look.
Right, and what you'll see is, as a consequence, that one of the kind of fallouts of these covert wars is that in the aftermath, the regions and sometimes whole nations are transformed from enforcement-free zones into major centers of the traffic. I'll give you one example. When we went into Afghanistan in 1979, the annual harvest was about 100 to 200 tons. By the time the CIA secret war was over, it had gone up tenfold from 100 to 200 tons to 2,000 tons. Okay? Yeah. By 1999, at the end of the civil war that followed the CIA secret war, Afghanistan's production was up to over 4,000 tons. And it was providing 75% of the world's illicit heroin supply.
But what you're saying is the CIA's response to that would be to say, yes, that may be true. In fact, it is true. But look, we got the Soviets out of Afghanistan.
Well, let's take the more recent example. Let's take our great victory in Afghanistan. The Bush administration decided instead of putting boots on the ground, U.S. conventional forces going in there, they would run the Afghan operation in 2001 just like they ran the secret war in Afghanistan from 1979 to 1992. So they brought all these old CIA operatives out of retirement or from posts where they've been transferred out of there. They gave them $70 million in $100 bills, bundles of them. They put them on helicopters and they flew them into the warlord areas, particularly the Northern Alliance area. And they revived all of the drug lords that had been pushed out of the country by the Taliban, okay? In the year 2000, the Taliban decided to ban opium and heroin production. They were producing about 4,600 tons. Being an incredibly repressive regime, their ban was very effective in all the areas they controlled. And Afghanistan's opium production by 2001, by June, July 2001, just a few months before 9/11 and the start of our war there, had dropped from 4,600 tons. It had crashed downward to 180 tons, okay, by all statistics, UN and US. Okay, so we go in there with our $70 million. The warlords break open their arsenals. They hire their troops. They sweep in. They take Kabul. They sweep across the countryside. There's a political vacuum. And these warlords, come drug lords, then take over the countryside. Within 1 year, Afghanistan's opium production had gone from 180 tons to 3,400 tons. And it's climbing. And Afghanistan is now the world's first opium monocrop.
Alfred McCoy is the author of the book called The Politics of Heroin: CIA Complicity in the Global Drug Trade. He's an historian at the University of Wisconsin in Madison.
Ladies and gentlemen, fellow Americans, lady Americans, this is James Brown. I want to talk to you about one of our most deadly killers in the country today. I had a dream the other night, and I was sitting in my living room. I dozed off to sleep, so I started dreaming. I dreamed I walked in a place, and I saw a real strange, weird object standing up talking to the people. And I found out it was heroin, that deadly drug that go in your vein. He said, "I came to this country without a passport. Ever since then, I've been hunted and sought. My little white grains are nothing but waste, soft and deadly and bitter to taste. But I'm a world of power, and all know it's true. Use me once and you'll know it too."
For almost 10 years, Anne Marlowe maintained a heroin habit. While she had a successful career on Wall Street, she never resorted to selling drugs or her body to maintain her habit. She never hit rock bottom. She quit when she wanted, and she never did it again. The antithesis of the junkie stereotype. Marlowe's memoir is called How to Stop Time, Heroin from A to Z. Now, Marlowe doesn't deny she was an addict. She just says that heroin doesn't have to ruin your life. Marlowe told Anne Strangechamps about the first time she did heroin.
It felt very benign. That was what surprised me. I expected heroin to have an edge to it that it didn't have. It felt very reassuring. It felt like the best parts of a mushroom high. I think I even recognized that that's part of what made it so dangerous, that if it felt scary, it wouldn't be so seductive.
Did you feel high, or did you just feel happy, just as though you felt normal, but everything felt really wonderful?
No, it felt beyond normal. You know, it was very euphoric. And I'm not sure it ever felt quite as good as it felt, you know, the first week or two of doing it. Because once you become used to the euphoria, every cell is straining for it. Every cell is remembering its memory of that euphoria. But the first time, it takes you completely by surprise.
I know this must be impossible to describe, but I'm always curious. When people say it made you feel euphoric, how euphoric? I mean, how happy did you feel?
Well, I would say I didn't feel happier than I'd ever felt, even on drugs. I mean, I'd say it was like getting really, really good news, but better than that. You know, it's not a feeling you have to do heroin to feel. But what's seductive about heroin is that it makes the feeling infinitely repeatable. You can have it whenever you have $10.
What were you doing in your life at the time? You were working, right?
Oh, yeah. I was working all, you know, throughout that period. I guess when I began, I was working in an office. I was a legal recruiter, a headhunter in familiar terms, for tax lawyers. And after 3 years, I continued to do that on my own. And actually, I've been making my living that way ever since. So I was making a living, in fact, making a good living all during that period. It, you know, it helped that it was a phone business and it was somewhat flexible as to time. You know, I didn't have to be somewhere, part of me, every day at 9 o'clock.
But you were not by any means the kind of stereotypical picture of a junkie. I mean, you were somebody who was making a good living and, you know, holding down a responsible job, that kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, I knew other people like that, too. I think that's part of the story that doesn't get told, you know, both because the anti-drug hysterics have a lot invested in making people think that, you know, the minute you take an illegal drug, you become completely dysfunctional. And I guess I insist in the book that there are plenty of good reasons not to take illegal drugs other than their practical effects. To me, the spiritual effects of the drugs are much more nefarious than, you know, maybe they will lower your income by $10,000 a year.
What do you mean the spiritual effects of the drug?
Well, I think that this search for endlessly repeated identical experience tends to close you in on yourself, and it makes people stop growing. There's really no interest in reaching out for new experiences if you have something that satisfies you. You know, I think that all growth comes from dissatisfaction of some kind, and people who choose to use heroin heavily or become addicted to heroin are choosing a predictable experience over a new experience, you know, every time they do it.
It's interesting because I think we have, you know, another stereotype of the heroin user or serious drug user is that this is somebody who's a risk taker. But I think you're sort of suggesting that these are people who, in fact, are choosing to do something kind of safe. These are people who are fleeing from the harder experiences of life.
Yeah, I think the only risk-taking element of heroin is the surroundings, the context, the fact that it's illegal, that, you know, often it involves going to a bad part of town and dealing with rough people to get it. If heroin were legal, I think that that aura of the outlaw that surrounds the heroin user now would totally disappear, and people would see it for the utterly bourgeois and mundane experience it really is.
What made you finally decide to stop?
Been there and done that. It seemed like an experience that I had exhausted. And I guess I also felt that my life was better without it.
In what way?
I felt that it was more interesting and that I was taking more risks and exploring more new activities than I would have had I been doing heroin. And you know, like most people who use it, I was kind of looking for an excuse to stop after a certain stage. I was also getting older. You know, I was approaching 40. I was 37 when I stopped. And I thought, gee, you know, this is kind of old to be doing this. You know, people my age are running corporations and governments and, you know, teaching at universities and writing books and doing all kinds of things. And here I am hanging out in the East Village, you know, with a bunch of musicians who are younger than me and who aren't really going anywhere with their lives. And is this really where I want to be?
When you first wrote about using heroin, I think you kind of discovered that you'd unleashed a barrage of criticism. You got a lot of angry letters, angry phone calls from people who were angry at you for two different reasons. And on the one side, people were angry at you because they accused you of glamorizing heroin use. And on the other side, other addicts wrote and said, you know, you never hit rock bottom. You don't have the authority to write about heroin. How do you make sense of both those two kinds of criticisms?
Well, I think that they boil down to one criticism, which is that our culture has largely made up its mind about what heroin means within the culture and that it has to have a certain arc. You have to, quote, hit rock bottom and end up living on the street. I mean, I was very amused when, you know, someone wanted to interview me for a TV show and wanted to put me on with a bunch of prostitutes. And I said, well, what am I supposed to have in common with them, if you don't mind my asking? And they said, well, you mean you didn't have a boyfriend who pimped you out? And I was just, I thought it was hilarious. You know, the stereotype is so pervasive in our culture that no one wants to hear that we might just have got it wrong. The idea is that unless you lose all your money, lose your family, you're living on the street, that you somehow haven't had this experience. I think also any form of writing about addictive drugs is thought suspect in our culture. There's this assumption that any form of discussing them in print incites people to take them.
So it sounds like you discovered that writing about heroin was actually more scandalous than taking heroin.
Yeah, I think that's the case. I think like a lot of things in our culture, it's okay as long as you do it and repent that you've done it. If you are unrepentant, if you decide that it wasn't a good idea but it didn't ruin your life, no one wants to hear about that. It also, you know, it affects, there's a huge rehab industry in this country, which if you ask me is 90% useless. Mm. You know, if people want to pay to go to rehab, that's fine. But they're essentially doing something that they could be either doing or not doing on their own. And unless they can do it on their own, they won't be able to do it in rehab either.
You said earlier that you don't regret taking heroin. Would you recommend it to other people?
No, I wouldn't. I mean, I think there's other ways to get every single experience that you can get from heroin. And my advice to someone who's taking it would be to stop. But I don't think that if someone is taking it, that it's the end of the world. And I think the more you give that person the impression that he or she's doing something incredibly evil, dangerous, and scandalous, the more likely it is that he or she will continue to do it. You know, I think that the key to stopping heroin is recognizing its essential boringness. And the more we demonize it, the more we feed into the sorts of feelings that make people think it's an interesting thing to do. And it's not.
Ann Marlow is the author of the memoir called How to Stop Time, Heroin from A to Z. Anne Strainchamp spoke with her.
Death of me. Heroin. You know that it's my wife, it's my life, because a mina to my vein leads to a center in my head.
It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can buy a tape of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Drugs, program number 1219A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio by Steve Paulson, Veronica Rickert, Doug Gordon, Anne Strainchamps, Mary Lou Finnegan, and Charles Monroe Kane, with engineering help from Marv Nunn and Kirill Owen.
PRI. Public Radio International.